getting back to our origin of We the People. Tackling current issues, both political and legal, with common sense. As We the People, we must bring common sense back to make our lives better. Only on Now Media TV.
Welcome to another episode of We the People. I'm your hostess, Alina Gonzalez-Dockery, and today we're diving into one of the most urgent, emotional, and often misunderstood realities facing millions of families. What happens when the immigrant dream collides with legal uncertainty? Our guest, attorney Elizabeth Trefonas, and you may recall she has been on the show before, has spent nearly two decades standing beside individuals who feel lost in a system they don't understand. She is the only lawyer in Wyoming specializing in both criminal and immigration law, and she has dedicated her career to helping people navigate complex circumstances with dignity, clarity, and hope. Elizabeth, I am so grateful to have you here today as we start with a topic many viewers are living through right now, when hope turns into fear and their immigration dream suddenly feels at risk. So welcome.
Thank you. Good to see you, Alina.
You know, I mean, it's you see it on the news and you're seeing things that I would say most people, even if they said what I voted for was not a mother on her way to school being pulled over and all of a sudden ICE is involved. So what is some of the biggest fears someone faces when their immigration status or visa becomes uncertain?
Right. I think practically and obviously speaking, they're concerned that their life is going to be torn apart or they're going to be torn apart from their family. I have clients who have been here three decades, recently going to work, get a traffic stop, and now they're detained. And that's their whole world. I think any one of us, if we thought about not making it home tonight,
well, and I know for a fact that like as people who work for us, their brother-in-law who's been here over three decades got picked up while he was at work, not doing anything, just simply working. So it's really a conundrum. And I know for myself, I tell my clients who are here, you know, who are legal residents, and even I have some of my parents' friends that are carrying around their passports to prove citizenship or residency. So besides that, how can someone protect themselves legally when they don't know the language or the system?
Sure. First of all, I agree with you. Most people are now carrying their paperwork, and we do advise that people do that if they have it. The other thing that we advise, right, there's approximately 66,000 immigrants detained currently, which is just about doubled since January. And that's a rotating number. And roughly 73% of those people don't have criminal convictions or they've been arrested on something minor like a traffic offense. So this is very real for people. And how to stay out of those crosshairs and how to protect yourself is a big conversation. The first thing is don't speak to people you don't know. ICE is often not in a uniform. They're not in marked vehicles. If someone's asking you your identity and your status, you very politely may decline to answer those questions. So I advise people to practice being quiet with strangers, you know, practice stranger danger like we did back in the 80s, you know. If you don't know who the person is that's talking to you, you are not required to talk with them. Learn what a warrant is and what it's not, when you're required to give information and when you're not, and hedge on not giving it. I mean, any human being can have a conversation with any other human being, and anyone can decline a conversation with a human being. Until you see a court order or a subpoena, ask if you're free to leave and walk away. And ask for a translator. If you're not understanding, don't nod your head and be polite and smile. That's what we tend to do. Mm-hmm. I learn Spanish. It's hard to be in a second language or third language for everybody. And we tend to want to just smile and nod and be polite. That starts to look like consent when you're dealing with an officer. So really practicing how to ask for a translator and then being quiet. That's very important. And asking if you're free to leave. Those are those first initial contacts with ICE that we are recommending and practicing with our people and our community here.
And that is, actually, I'm going to use your advice because I do tell my clients, make sure that you have your residency card. I have clients who, I mean, their children with special needs, they're nonverbal, they're or mostly nonverbal. And now there's a fear even to take them to the doctors because what if somebody mistakes that, you know? But I am going to suggest that now. So that is so important. So let's take, for instance, somebody who's already in the process, say there's an application process already in progress. What are some of the concrete steps someone can take today to safeguard their immigration path?
Right. Always talking with an immigration attorney who's actually knowledgeable is a good start. Researching on the actual government websites is a good start. The process goes all through uscis.gov. All the forms where people are trying to do things the right way can be found there. But they are technical, and understanding which ones apply to you and which ones don't is important. We're also seeing some concerns. I'm getting this question more and more that if I start the process to do this the right way, am I flagging myself now with ICE and to be detained? And the answer is we're going to see that more and more. In the past, USCIS and doing things the right way, if you will, didn't flag you for deportation concerns. We are aware that ICE now has a new database, a new AI database, and they will be talking with other agencies. There have been requests to the IRS, for example. That's all new. So really talking with an immigration attorney who knows what red flags there are for you, which and where there aren't red flags, that you can be secure in submitting your requests. But the first thing I would say is starting to understand that showing your continual physical presence in the United States becomes important. So maintaining those leases that you've had over the years, or your billing statements, or being able to access those credit card statements, or even your taxes. The US government is always going to want to see that you are, in fact, filing your taxes. So some of us, you know, I guess in the legal world, we keep paper all the time, and these types of records, you know, digitally scanned everywhere. But for a lot of people, that first request from the immigration attorney is going to be, bring me your birth certificate, proof that you've been in the United States, and your proof of filing your taxes for however long you've been in the US. And having that ready to go and know where that is can be very helpful to getting that process started.
See, and that is absolutely astonishing that if knowing that many undocumented, they'll have a tax ID number so that they can file their tax returns and have that path. But now ICE may be accessing, and those are now, red flags for them is something else. And, I've been coming across this, and I don't do criminal law, so, or any like, I do family probate and estate planning, but I had a client that we're about to go to mediation, and he's like, is there any way we can do it by Zoom? I'm scared to go to court. And it used to be it didn't matter. In a family law setting, it did not matter whether you were here legally, whether you were documented, it did not matter. You were able to go to court, you were able to go through the process without fear of retribution or ICE being there. But I have a client now that he's like, what can we do? Because we're required to go in person to mediation. Or if we have an in-person court hearing, it is now becoming a major block, if you will. So have you been dealing with that within Wyoming? Because I know that is becoming a very realistic fear for my clients.
Right. We haven't seen ICE in the courthouse yet, but they are on the courthouse steps in various locations. So walking out of court, especially after a conviction, if it's a criminal situation, can get you into ICE custody pretty quickly. When it comes to family law, though, there's some interesting policy considerations, right? State law is what drives, as you know, family law and divorces and child support and those types of things. And the state has a vested interest in making sure children are paid for, and not part of the, you know, on the dole, so to speak, of state funds. So Department of Family Services and probate and those things have always traditionally been separate from immigration concerns. And the reason why is because we want a parent to show up and pay for that kid. We want that divorce to be finalized, or those protection orders to be realized, or the estate to be settled. And that is a separate concern from someone's immigration status. But if we're going to start putting those things together, I think you are going to find that people no-show on the family child support case. I often tell people, though, what's your risk to showing up and what's your risk to not showing up, right? If you don't show up, will a warrant issue for you? If that's going to be the case, say you were summoned and now you're ignoring that summons, or you're held in contempt of court because you didn't show up, then it may be less risky to show up and see how it goes and hope that ICE isn't there and try to get your business affairs in order, your family affairs in order. Because if you no-show and there's an arrest warrant for you, now we are guaranteed to eventually have a detention and a problem and a contact with ICE. So I think a lot of the strategy with clients is, well, let's weigh and mitigate our worst case scenario. Which one gives us the best chance to handle our affairs and do this in a safe manner? Also, if we know we're going to be detained by ICE, we start getting ready for, okay, can we get a bond with ICE? How are we going to pay that bond with ICE? How are we going to get you home from the ICE detention facility once that bond is paid? And although that's scary to maybe go into ICE custody, if you know you're coming back out in a couple of weeks, and you can get that plan with your family and your employer that you're going to be not around for just a little bit and your bond is ready to be paid, maybe that's a process that we can walk through that's not so so tragically traumatic, and ripping you out of your household without notice.
And these are all great suggestions. And I mean, honestly, I'm going to be telling my clients as well. Coming up after the break, we're going to tackle an even heavier intersection. What happens when a criminal charge threatens not just your record, but your entire future? Stay with us and tune back in. Welcome back to We the People. Want more of what you're watching? Stay connected to We the People and every Now TV, Now Media TV favorite, live or on demand anytime. Download the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and enjoy nonstop bilingual programming in English and Spanish. Prefer podcasts? Listen directly from our website at www.nowmedia.tv. From business and news to culture and community, Now Media TV is streaming 24/7, ready whenever you are. We're here with attorney Elizabeth Trifonas, who has been guiding us through the realities many immigrants are and families face within our legal system. We shift to one of the most devastating moments someone can encounter when a criminal charge disrupts everything: freedom, future, and immigration status. Many of our viewers live with the fear that one accusation, true or not, can derail their lives. Criminal and immigration law overlap in ways the public rarely understands, increasing risk for vulnerable communities. Elizabeth, why does a criminal charge often feel like a life sentence, even before a verdict?
Well, I think it's often going to change the course of your life. You'll probably be court ordered to do several things. You may have been arrested. That arrest can trigger a cascade of ICE detentions, which can trigger deportations or at least a removal case that you may need to defend. I very rarely hear people, I would venture to guess that most people don't wake up in the morning and decide, you know, I'd like to go get arrested today. That's what I'd like to have happen in my course of the day. So most people, when they find they're in contact with law enforcement, something has surprised them. Something has not gone according to their plan, or they've made maybe some decisions that are not, they would take back if you asked them if they could go back in time. What first happens when you're detained with a criminal charge, if you're arrested, which can happen in a state like Wyoming just from a traffic stop and not having a driver's license, is you're going to go see a judge and they're going to address bond. And you are entitled to a reasonable bond, and that bond is to ensure community safety, your safety, and that you're not a flight risk and you're going to come back to court. And that number often is very high to ensure community safety and that you're going to return for future hearings. So a lot of people will feel like they got this life sentence or they're convicted even before the case starts because they can't pay that bond. And so they're going to sit in jail. Most misdemeanors, can process around here 60 days. Felonies, we're looking at 90 days, 6 months, a year. So that alters the course of your life pretty quickly if you can't pay that bond. And a lot of clients will say to me, well, even if I have the bond, the judge has now put me on all these restrictions. I've got to do breath tests and I've got to check in with agents. I'm not even convicted yet. They're really two separate things. The conviction and your presumption that you're innocent, we'll get to that hopefully as the case proceeds. But that immediate, now I'm being court ordered to do all these things and I have to pay this bond. Yeah, your life is restricted before you're convicted, and that's the way that it is. And a lot of people really feel like until you're convicted, you shouldn't be court ordered to pay anything or do anything, but that's not the way our system is set up.
No, and neither is it here. And then on top of that, when you have your pretrial release conditions, and that's what, the pretty language saying you are required to do this, this, this. If you violate any of those pretrial conditions here in Florida, that's a new misdemeanor charge on
Right.
top of it. And you're back in jail, and you will see, and a judge gets to determine whether they're going to release you on the original bond or make or require you to pay another. So it can be a nice little cycle, if you will, of I mean, it's just one comedy of errors after another if you happen to just do
I call it the toilet bowl of the criminal justice system. Sometimes you're getting flushed in it. And gotta climb out. I had one client recently. She was on a, we call it the 24/7 program, where you're subjected to regular drug testing in that case. And when she'd show up for her drug test, it was showing a positive. Now, a lot of people say, well, it's positive because she probably used drugs. And sometimes, yes, that's what's happening. But she actually was getting arrested on those positive tests and then going to our hospital and getting another test done and showed that it were false positives that were getting triggered. We didn't figure out why. Sometimes there's medical conditions, but she was terrified every time she went back to the jail to do those tests because she just, it was just very traumatic. And if you've never been detained, it might be hard to understand, but that booking in process and the body searching and the lack of your liberty and being told you're not getting out of a jail cell for, who knows how long. It's real trauma, real traumatic experience that people go through every day.
Oh, and the trauma of just set aside the humiliation, because it is a humiliating position to be in, because you're thrust in a holding cell with, several dozen people, it's all of that. But on top of that, it is that fear of, like, I recall I had a friend, she was picked up, she didn't realize she had a tick, an unpaid ticket, her license was suspended. No problem. And she paid it and she had proof of it. And one officer was very nice. She goes, just make sure that you always have the paid ticket. It'll take time because it was a holiday weekend like Thanksgiving. Well, she was going through one county where they have zero tolerance. Didn't matter. She showed him the paid ticket. She didn't show him that she showed even the warning the other officer did. And lo and behold, she gets arrested. They send, she's in jail. I bailed her out. I paid the bond for her to get out. It still took another 12 hours. And that was without the specter of if you are here and you're an immigrant, what happens then? And that, segues into my next question. How do criminal law and immigration law intersect in ways people don't even expect?
Right. A lot of the things that trip people up are going in and pleading guilty without having counsel. I have a lot of clients that have really messed up their permanent residency, their ability to be a U.S. citizen down the line, the ability to apply for their permanent residency through the immigration judge. We call that cancellation of removal. That's when we have an immigration case where we show up and say, yes, judge, my client is here undocumented. They are removable. However, they qualify for cancellation of removal. And under certain requirements, if we prove that, then my client is actually eligible for permanent residency from the immigration judge. But the biggest hang up that people just don't understand, they come in, say they get a little pot is illegal, marijuana is illegal in Wyoming. You just get a little citation, you show up to court, and you plead guilty because it's just going to be a fine. Well, that, and you pay the fine, that's great, no big deal, until now it undoes everything for you as an immigrant. Having a a possession charge or violating a controlled substances crime like that, it is still federally illegal as well, will undo your immigration situation in the United States very, very quickly. So walking in and thinking you're just going to handle it and it's not going to be a big deal on the criminal side has numerous implications on your immigration side, and you need to be sure to slow the process down. Tell the judge you need time. You need a translator if you need one. And courts need to give you that translator. So don't just nod and say yes. Say, I need help to understand. Plead not guilty. Slow the process down. Get some help and figure out not only how to clean up the criminal situation, but what are the downstream consequences and resolution as you move forward in maybe a plea agreement, or if you're going to go to trial, because you have to sometimes to defend your immigration situation. So I give the example of I have a client who got a citation for marijuana, walked in, pled guilty, actually just paid it, and then did not realize that that would change their DACA status. In a workforce, worksite enforcement situation, he was detained by ICE. That little pot citation subjects them to mandatory detention in the ICE process. Getting bond is not possible. So then we're fighting his deportation case and his ability to remain in the United States because he thought he had it all handled. But really, what he lined up was significant consequences. On the other hand, if you had come to someone who understood that pleading guilty to that marijuana charge and was just a fine was going to do something like that, maybe we work a deal with the prosecutor. Maybe it's dismissed. Maybe the interaction with law enforcement wasn't correct and it should be suppressed. Maybe there is an alternative to instead of being a pot charge, maybe you take a reckless driving charge because that doesn't hurt your immigration situation. So understanding the nuances on what makes someone inadmissible or deportable and how those crimes affect the person downstream is a technical conversation you need to have with an immigration person who knows how these play out and how your case specifics, your entry to the US, your case history, your family history, how those all play together to set up the right resolution in the criminal case so that downstream the immigration case follows the way that we want it to for the safety and security of our families to stay together.
Elizabeth, for our viewers, you are definitely an expert that needs to be contacted for those who have family members or even acquaintances that may be finding themselves, especially in the Wyoming area. How can our viewers learn more or get help from you and your office?
Sure. You're welcome to go to our website at trifonislaw.com. You're welcome to email us at trifonis@trifonislaw.com. We have a policy where we return calls and emails within 2 business days unless it's an emergency. Emergencies are ICE detentions. We can represent people all over the country in any ICE detention facility and before any of the immigration judges. Most of our immigration judges allow us all to appear by WebEx these days. Also, if you have a loved one that's in detention, you can also often attend their hearings by WebEx. The judge may or may not let you in those hearings, but those immigration judge WebEx links are all available online. And you can also find your loved ones through the ICE detainer locator system, which is online as well. But shoot us an email, give us a call, give us a half second to catch up, and we'll get right back to you. And we can piece these things together as best we can.
And I think that is so, I want to really stress the fact that you can represent people throughout the US. So like here in Florida, where we have the lovely alligator Alcatraz, we want to make sure that if you have an issue, call Elizabeth. We're going to tune right back in. Stay with us as we speak more with Elizabeth about the judicial system and how sometimes it feels like the cards are stacked against those that do not have. Tune right back in. Welcome back to We the People. As we continue our conversation with attorney Elizabeth Trifonas, we turn to a reality many viewers feel deeply. The justice system feels overwhelmingly inaccessible and sometimes even designed for someone else. Today, we're going to break down why this happens and what can be done to close that gap. Because access to justice is one of the greatest barriers for marginalized communities, especially immigrants and Spanish-speaking families. Confusion, cost, and fear often keep people from seeking help until it's too late. Elizabeth, why do people feel that the legal system is not for me, or it's just for the privileged few?
Right. I also work doing public defense, and I get that question a lot. Maybe if you were able to pay for more assistance or pay your way through the system, you'd have a better outcome. That's still very much a deeply held feeling in the country. But access really becomes difficult for people when there's that language barrier. In a state like Wyoming, our courts have been slow to translate and to provide translation services to people. It's doing a better job now, but I mean, it's 2025. Translation, 30% of our community speaks Spanish. That should be an available thing to have translated regularly in our courts. But I would say, even walking into our court physically, most of them don't have any bilingual information as you're even walking in through security. Or our bailiff doesn't speak Spanish. So when they're asking you to take things out of your pockets to go through the metal detector, that in and of itself becomes confusing for people. I've never been arrested in a country or had to go to a court in a country where I didn't know the language. That would be terrifying, and very confusing. So making sure you have someone that can help you translate your interactions through court, asking judges for translated materials, asking for an interpreter. And slowing the process down and getting help to understand it is essential. Also, even in your language, if you are new to the criminal justice system or new to the court system, it's very complicated. It's very confusing. There are so many rules of criminal procedure and civil procedure and appellate procedure and local court rules. An attorney is, I highly recommend one. Get one. And have that person in your corner that can explain to you all these words that you're hearing maybe for the first time that you've never experienced before and what they mean. Slow the process down. Don't nod your head and say you understand something when you don't. The only way to protect your rights is to maintain them and stand up with them. And you can't do that if you don't know what they are or you're not understanding the process. Every judge is going to treat everybody that shows up to court as if they have the experience of a lawyer. That's required. So if you do not, please go find it. But yeah, that the money is a barrier, and the public defender system, which I truly believe in, it's the caseloads are they're high. They are enormous. But don't go it alone. I think that to give a shout out to my public defender people, they are the most experienced criminal attorneys in that courtroom. They know how to do things very quickly on the fly, and they're experts. So to go into court, criminal court in particular, alone, when you have that ability to ask for help from the public defender system, please do that. And again, slow the process down. Plead not guilty to things. Ask questions. Ask the judge for more time. Time is usually on the defendant's side, and it's usually on petitioner's side. And it certainly is more helpful if you understand the decisions you're making and why you're making them. And reach out to your local access to justice centers. We have several in the state of Wyoming. I'm not familiar with maybe Florida. Ask the court clerks if they've got that list of free services and reach out.
Well, and so at least here in Florida, I can vouch for this. You have a right to an attorney, obviously, everywhere in the United States, a right to an attorney if you cannot afford one for criminal. We also have court appointed for dependency cases. That's in the, when the Department of Children and Families or the state is trying to remove children for abuse, neglect, or abandonment. Also, the translators. You have a right to a translator in those courts as well as domestic violence court. Now, where it gets sticky for us here, unlike like say New York City, where New York State actually has court-appointed counsel even in family law cases, in family, in other civil cases, you don't have a right to an attorney. And that's when we look towards like legal aids, which I used to be a director of legal aid, two different legal aid societies helping indigent clients. But even still, if you do not know the language, or if English is your second or third language, it is not your natural language, ask for that interpreter or pay for an interpreter to come with you to court. It is vital because there are so many times where something is said in English that doesn't translate the same way in Spanish or, Czech or whatever language it is that you speak. I tell clients that all the time, but even I was in docket calling it for Miami Court, Miami-Dade County, and the judge who spoke, speaks Spanish, had to keep repeating, "We're not allowed to conduct court in Spanish. We have to conduct court in English." So that's even more vital if you can f hire someone. And, in the public defenders, I mean, they are absolutely, I call them the beasts of the criminal court system. It always infuriates me when I hear people saying, "Oh, a pretend lawyer." I'm like, are you kidding me? They're some of the best attorneys I've ever known for criminal and litigation. Now,
And you bring up too with immigration law and your immigration cases, you're allowed to have an attorney and you have the right to an attorney if you pay for one. So some things people can do is, maybe you need to put together a fund where you're saving some money so that you can retain counsel when you need to and have that plan. Some of the things that people should plan when they're detained or if they're going to be detained, perhaps, is know the phone number you're going to call. Have it memorized because you're not going to have your cell phone and your property when you're detained. That person needs to know that they need to answer the phone. And you should have somebody who knows how to access funds to pay bond or to get you to counsel or to get an attorney retained for you. And then also, if you have children, know who's picking up your kids. Have that set up with the school so that if you are not able to go get your children at the end of the day, you're not worried and they're not stressed out about who's picking them up safely and getting them home later. So know the phone number. Have someone be able to access funds and make sure your kids have a backup plan for who's picking them up if you are detained.
And I would add, have a child power of attorney prepared. That was something years ago. A lot of the like attorneys here in Southwest Florida got together and they were assisting individuals and doing like a power of attorney for children so that to avoid dependencies, to avoid children being removed and placed in foster care and such, but also have that emergency guardianship just in case. That's something that I try to stress, regardless if they're whatever your legal status is or what have you. If you are a parent with young children, you should have some backups anyway, in case you never know, you may get in an accident or something. But especially now with the immigration climate that we are seeing ourselves in, which goes beyond with what was going on in like 2012 and 13. That is something that I stress to people all the time. It's like, make sure you have that because you want to ensure that whoever that family member or that friend of the family that takes those kids, they also have authority to go and for medical care and things like that. So it's something to always take into consideration. And I know what we've been focusing on the immigrant issues, but what should citizens, let's say people who are US citizens, do right now if they feel trapped by legal issues and don't know where to start?
Finding those attorneys that you can trust and having those consultations, take the time to meet with an attorney, take the time to build a relationship with somebody that you trust that's a lawyer who's experienced in the area. If you're financially able to do that. I always tell my clients when we do consultations, I'd shop around if I were in their shoes. Sure, you talked with me. This is what it will cost to retain me. This is my skill set. But I would shop around and ask other lawyers and see what who is the best fit, right? We're humans and this is a relationship between each other. It needs to be a good fit. If you're having a hard time finding help, ask those court clerks. I have yet to see a court where they don't have a list of available services. And then also just know that when I've never seen a judge be offended that someone asked for more time so that they could protect their rights. That is their job. They're expecting you to plead not guilty on a criminal case. It always makes me kind of insane when the newspaper prints, oh, so and so pled not guilty at their arraignment. Yes, we always do that 100% of the
I
time. It's not because they're not taking accountability. It's because it's the magic words for the process and to review the evidence and to protect my client's rights, and to walk through due process of law the way we're supposed to. So if a person has to go to court on their own, slow it down. Take the time to say, Judge, I need more time, or I don't understand, or I need that interpreter. And know that in our courts, they're going to ask you if you need an interpreter in English, which I always find a little hysterical because maybe you don't even know what I'm saying to you in English, asking you if you need an interpreter. So have that prepared and know that no one's offended in the courtroom, that you want to understand the process and you want help understanding the process.
And I can assure our viewers, the judges prefer that you know your rights, that you are adequately protected by your rights. And if you say, I need time to be able to find an attorney, regardless of what style case it is, they're going to give you that time. They want you to exercise those rights because it is about the 14th Amendment right to due process.
Absolutely.
So, coming up in our final segment, immigration policy changes and how they disrupt lives, what families can do, and the reforms that could finally bring stability. Don't go anywhere and tune right back. We're going to continue with Elizabeth. Welcome to We the People. Don't miss a second of this show or any of our non-Now Media TV favorites, streaming live and on demand anytime, everywhere. Download the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS for instant access to bilingual programming in English and Spanish. Prefer podcasts? Listen anytime at www.nowmedia.tv. From news and policy to culture and community, Now Media TV keeps you connected 24/7. Welcome back. As we close out today's conversation with attorney Elizabeth Trifonas, we turn to one of the most destabilizing challenges families face: immigration policies that shift overnight, leaving people uncertain, unafraid, and unprepared. Policies often change faster than people can adjust, especially with a stroke of a pen. Families feel uprooted not because of wrongdoing, but because the system keeps moving beneath their feet, literally. Elizabeth, what policy changes have you seen that have been such an abrupt turnaround in the, say, in the recent year?
Right. Well, I think the detention policy, I think the American people were explained that ICE detentions were going to go after the worst of the worst criminals. And I think all of us want to be safe. And that was a policy pitch that most of us were behind, frankly, on all sides of the table. What we're seeing, though, is a little bit different. ICE is detaining folks. 73% of them right now is the number, don't have a criminal conviction. They may have something pending. They may have a minor traffic citation or nothing at all. And so that's a big policy shift. Another big policy shift that recently happened September 25th, the courts that are in charge of the immigration world changed some of the definitions on what it meant to be an arriving alien or an alien seeking admission or in the statute. And all of a sudden, I've done this for 20 years, but all of a sudden at the end of September, someone like a DACA, who was detained, was always eligible for bond. But because they were brought into the country as a child, and the case I'm thinking of, which really broke my heart, they were not entitled to bond after September 25th any longer. The immigration judges read the law to say that they no longer have jurisdiction over an arriving alien or someone who's seeking admission, even though my client, the one that I'm thinking of, had been brought in 3 decades prior. So he was not entitled to bond. He was entitled to still fight his deportation case, though, but he was going to do that while he was in custody. So we are seeing long detentions in ICE centers, and those have been some new changes. Recently, however, the good news is some immigrants put their foot down and said they weren't going to be bullied and just accept a deportation. They were going to stay put in the detention center and they were going to fight their cases. And so we are seeing success out of the courts in California telling immigration judges that they do have to have at least a bond hearing for these people. So it's It's shifting. My advice to someone, in the beginning of September became different in the beginning of October, and now it's different coming into December. So it's a moving target. We do our best to keep moving with it and adjusting as best we can. We're also seeing reforms in, right, the filing fees for things like H-1B visas, and now it's $100,000 to submit an application for that. That's significant. Those are our professionals. Those are our tech people, our PhD candidates. I'm not clear on the policy on not wanting good PhD candidate students, and people to come into our economies. I'm happy to discuss further how we're getting to the best of the best by requiring a $100,000 filing fee, but it's something that we're seeing new, and I suspect we'll see more of that in the legal ways to come to the country getting more and more expensive as well.
Well, isn't that kind of on par with the golden ticket that was being floated around by our current administration and president, saying that basically you can buy your way in if you have 5 million or something like that? I mean, I'm first gen US citizen. My parents are Cuban refugees. I know many friends that have immigrated here or who have escaped communism and were able to immigrate properly here. Okay. And I know many people, and especially in my line of work, but also personally, that have come across the border, without paperwork. And now that you just shocked me because, especially those that are DACA, because like, I am now preparing contingency plans if a mother or father who were brought over here when they were less than 6 years old or 10 years old, and because they had several crossings, they are now like they may be subject to deportation. And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't it just not even 10 years ago that we were all about we need to do something to help these poor kids that came over here as children to maintain their status or get legal status?
Right, I'm not sure. So right now we can do DACA renewals, but we can't do any new initial DACAs. That's been that way for a long time. So our DACAs really started, in the 2012 time frame and have been renewing every 2 years. But with the policies and the ICE detentions and not having bond, it was shocking. One of my clients who is DACA did get detained on a traffic citation. He was not allowed to have bond. He was married to a US citizen and had a US citizen child, and he was entitled to fight his deportation. But because at that time period in between, September and maybe now, he wasn't willing to sit in the detention center for maybe 6 months, a year and a half, while we fought that case. And it was heartbreaking to acquiesce to a deportation or voluntary departure under guard and to have them taken out of the country. From my perspective, we exported someone who had 3 decades of education, medical care, and talent, who was very well loved in our small community. And I just, again, what's the downstream to, I'm not understanding where the goal is, other than, I guess, to not have a community of immigrants. But that's not my preferred community. It's not the way the historical country has come to exist. I'm a big believer that statistically, actually, economies and communities that have immigrants are safer, have better economies, do thrive, and diversity is key to our biodiversity and our survival as a country. I suspect some people disagree in our administration with that line of thought, but I'd like to see some new reforms. Congress and the senators and our political leaders, this is a completely made up imaginary system. It's not air or gravity, it's not oxygen. We made it up. We continue to make it up. If we don't like it, we can change it. So where's the payoff to this dysfunction in the system, and what are our goals? And if our political leaders' goals are not aligned with what our community's goals are, we need to get involved and vote and change that. So if you're a lawful permanent resident and you qualify to be a citizen, go do your citizenship. We need more voters. If this isn't the system we want, that's up to us, because it is an imagination of our politicians, and they're supposed to do what we are asking them to do with our votes. So
Okay, I love that you say all that, but the reality is unfortunately right now our political leadership is so broken because all they're doing is, and I will say this, and I don't mind saying this, that our current leadership, and I'm talking about congressional members because that's where the laws have to be changed. All they seem to be doing is kowtowing to the lobbyists or the PACs that give them money. And once they're reelected or elected, all they care about is the next election. They are not doing the bidding of the people. They are not looking at the United States. This is my soapbox. They are not going in common sense. They are not looking at the United States as a whole and what is in the true benefit and best interest of this country and the residents of this country. Because the bottom line is Marco Rubio, when he was a junior senator, he actually, and he was a Tea Party senator, he was elected during the Tea Party. He wrote up an amazing immigration reform bill. Adam Putnam, he was a former congressman from Florida. He was backing it. It was Obama's administration was coming in with an immigration reform. And what ended up happening was the leadership, the Tea Party leadership, like grabbed the newspaper and smacked him so hard over the head saying, you can't do this. And it got shelved. And it's a shame because we need meaningful reform. And for those of you who want to attack me for saying that, oh, I'm not MAGA or I've lost friends saying that I'm a Democrat because I talk about this. Let me remind you that as a Republican under Ronald Reagan, and subsequent to Ronald Reagan, we had the biggest amnesty passage under Ronald Reagan, the golden boy of the Republican Party, who would not be even admitted into the doors. And I will say this to the Democrats. I am not a Democrat because I wouldn't be allowed back in because I truly believed in what the Kennedy administration would be doing. And what is happening now is we have a hijacking by extremists, not common sense. So there's my soapbox. Sorry, Elizabeth. That
great
just,
stuff.
I had to get it off my chest. It's been a
Glad
while.
you did. I'm glad
And
that
this
you
is why people don't watch news with me.
that. Well, this is why this show is here. So, how to take back the Constitution and due process of law and make sure we're following the rules. I've had clients be moved and I've had the government not follow the rules. And what do you do when that happens? It's a great question. We're trying to figure that out. But I can tell you that if you acquiesce and don't stand up for yourself and don't try to uphold due process of law, then it's gone. It
That is
has
so
to be
true.
done by us standing up and saying, you know what, maybe I will sit in the detention center and plead my case and do a habeas corpus petition. Some folks were doing that and it's been successful, and I hope it will continue to be. But if you say, you're right, take all my rights away, well, then we know the result. You have to push back to see what we want happen, if that's what we want to happen. You know, we're a collective, I guess, and I know that we're a diverse collective, but if we can bridge the gaps together and have really hard conversations about what our policies are and what our long-term goals are, I think we'll get there. I trust our system and our constitution, and I think we can get there.
Oh, I agree. I trust the Constitution. I trust the people. It's about the people regaining their power. And that's what we need to do. Elizabeth, thank you so much. You are so insightful. Your compassion, your clarity, and your passion for your work is so abundantly clear. And your work shines a light on the struggles of so many people. To our viewers, remember, even in the most complicated legal situations, you are not alone, and understanding your rights is the first step toward protecting your future. Thank you for joining us on We the People. Until next time, stay informed, stay empowered, and stay connected.